Welcome to the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Why don't we get started? So I have to say you are in for a real treat. Because over the course of this book festival, you have certainly met a lot of authors. You get a chance to meet a lot of authors who write books about history. Well, as many of you know, Cleve has written a book about history, but he has also been a maker of history as well. And so he has been on the front lines of one of the great civil rights battles of our time, what some people have said might be the final great civil rights battle of our time, and that, of course, is the battle for rights for the LGBTQ communities. And what's amazing about Cleve's story is that he was there. He seems to pop up at just about every pivotal moment in the struggle for gay rights. So listen to this. So when the first generation of gay Americans realized that they were not alone in the world, Cleve Jones was among them. He was there. He was part of what's known as the Great Gay Migration, when gay people flocked to cities to establish ghettos for safety and community. Cleve was there when Harvey Milk was elected, the highest profile openly gay politician in America at the time. Sadly, Cleve was also there when Harvey Milk was assassinated and helped lead the community in mourning. And Cleve was there when Milk's assassin was found not guilty of murder, and Cleve helped lead the protests. Cleve was there when AIDS devastated the gay community, and when the federal government ignored pleas for help, Cleve was a key activist. Cleve created the AIDS quilt, a breakthrough in changing the hearts and minds of America so that the pandemic was taken seriously. Cleve was also there for the battle for marriage equality. And he's even been present in different countries. In the book, you'll learn that when Spain finally emerged from decades of dictatorship and gay people demanded to be treated as human beings, yes, Cleve was there too, dodging the rubber bullets of the government's fascist police squads. He has been everywhere. Please welcome gay civil rights icon, Cleve Jones.
Thank you.
So, Cleve, those are just some of the many stories you tell in your book, When We Rise, which was also the inspiration for the recent ABC television network series special by the same name. Let's start in the early years. People tend to want to see things through the 2017 lens when we live in a more enlightened time. But when you first arrived in San Francisco in the early 1970s, it was very different. The city you describe in your book, when I read it, I thought it was actually pretty frightening. It must have been frightening and also exhilarating when you first came to San Francisco. Talk about that.
Well, first of all, again, thank you all very much for coming. I appreciate it very much. And I have to say, when people say I created the AIDS Memorial Quilt, I want you to know I still can't sew. And that thing only happened because really, literally tens of thousands of people made it happen. But it was a good idea. And fortunately, people recognized the power of it. So I was this idiot white boy from Scottsdale, and I landed in the Tenderloin. And it was really scary. And one of the parts of it that I think the younger generation may not really fully be aware of or comprehend the implications of was that we were criminals. And I was in a, I was at the Mix recently, and somebody was eavesdropping on my conversation, and he accused me of exaggerating, and he said it was never illegal to be gay. I'm like, are you so stupid? But even in liberal San Francisco, several years after the Summer of Love, about 2000 adult gay men were being arrested every year for consenting sexual behavior. And every police department in the country had divisions whose sole responsibility was to entrap and arrest and imprison gay men. And a lot of those men lost everything, and many of them lost their lives because of that. So the police department and the fire department were both very segregated. There were a handful of non-white officers, but the police department was mostly Irish and Italian Catholic. There was a height limit. You had to be 6 feet tall. And they were just overtly and brutally homophobic and racist and misogynist. But I think what was happening on Polk Street was, for me, it was you never knew if you were going to be hurt. And especially if during the period before I found slightly secure housing, you know, that experience of being homeless and on the streets was pretty scary. And then it was also exhilarating. And the other thing that kept happening to me and continues to happen to this day is I just, through random chance, happened to meet the most extraordinary people. And it's like really nothing I did to make it happen, but I've been smart enough and perceptive enough to know it usually when it's happening and think, oh, I got to hang on to this person. But
well, you walk into a diner, you sit down for to get a cup of coffee, and who do you sit in? There's one empty seat in the place, and who is it?
Sylvester. You know, I met Sylvester my first night in San Francisco. The first lesbian activists I met were Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon, you know. It doesn't really get much better than that. And
so you couldn't turn to the police to help as you're being victimized, because they may victimize you as well. And at the same time, there's something going on called the Zebra Murders. People might not remember that one, and that was happening as well.
Yeah, there were the Zebra Killers, and this was and there was so much insanity going on. There was the Zebra Killers. Shortly after that was the SLA. Remember the Symbionese Liberation Army? And I think that crazy, sinister, dark side of the city, really, the lowest point we got was November of 78 with the horrible tragedy in Guyana with the People's Temple and Reverend Jim Jones. But yeah, the city, when I think about it then, it's always in fog. It's dark and scary and cold with just these little glimmers of fascinating potential and the consciousness that what we were doing was brand new. I think that's, if you have to say what's really, one of the things that's really changed for the young people like myself who were coming to the Bay Area from all over the world, you know, you knew that this was brand new. No one had seen this before, ever. And you didn't have to be political. You didn't have to be all that smart or educated to know that you were being permitted to be a part of this thing that no one had ever imagined before.
But yeah, in your
so
book,
exciting,
you talk
so
about
romantic.
People from your generation would actually say that they didn't know that they weren't the only ones who were gay. I mean, talk about this great gay migration that happened where people came from all over the United States to be in places like the Castro or in San Francisco, Polk Street, because they could not be themselves back in Scottsdale or wherever they were from.
Yeah, it's really, and I think when I speak to younger people, some of them really don't quite comprehend what I'm saying, but I came from a middle-class family from the Midwest who valued education. So I grew up in a house full of books with parents who were very engaged and always watched the news. You know, every night we always watched the Walter Cronkite together before dinner. And so we were informed and we were educated and we were paying attention. And when the bullies started on me, which started getting really bad around 7th, 8th, how old are we when we're in 8th grade? Is that like 13? Yeah. That's when it started getting really bad. And I had been conscious that I was different in a way that was perceived as very negative early on. But around middle school, you know, it started to kind of crystallize in the words that were being used. I looked it up in my father's textbooks. He was a professor of clinical psychology. And, you know, it's in the TV miniseries, they reenact it sort of, but those textbooks had, you know, explanations of how prefrontal lobotomies worked and electroconvulsive shock worked. And I know people who survived that. Rick Stokes, the man who ran against Harvey Milk, who Harvey beat in that last election, he was a survivor of forced electroconvulsive shock treatment. And so it was such a revelation when I picked up that Life magazine, and that in the series, that's not just a dramatic device. I was actually hiding in the library and reading this magazine, and came to this headline that said "Homosexuals in Revolt," and it was a revelation. You know, it was like, oh my God, I'm not. I knew that there were other people called homosexuals, but in my mind, they were all sick criminals, you know? And I kept thinking, I'm not a sick person. I'm not a criminal. I'm not a bad person. Am I the only one? And then suddenly to get this evidence that I wasn't the only one, that there was a movement, that it was part of the larger movement I'd already joined, and that there was this place called San Francisco. It was just astonishing. And so that same kind of revelation was happening all across the country and all around the world as this baby boomer generation began to understand that there was this other possibility. And my gosh, you could just see that. I mean, every sunny Saturday, there would be twice as many boys with their shirts off on the corner. And I appreciated that.
I think what's amazing in the story, every once in a while, you will timestamp in the book and you will say, you'll have just described some incredible, awful, or dramatic moment. And then you'll say, and I was 19 years old. Or I'll say, and I was 20 years old. To me, that was amazing. Like, you were so young when all of this was happening. I mean, today's millennials don't move out of their homes until they're 27. You were out there on the streets as a teenager.
Well, a lot of us were. And, you know, what, I'm going to stay in Phoenix and get beat up every day? I just didn't. I was going to kill myself. And my mom had gallbladder surgery, and my dad had disc operation, and there were a lot of pills in the house, pain pills and sleeping pills, and I was stealing them one by one very carefully and putting together a stockpile. And
it was an escape kit.
Yeah, I was so terrified. I was absolutely terrified, and I didn't want to be that kind of person. I didn't want to be a victim, and the idea of hitchhiking to San Francisco, you know, that was terrifying. But I knew if I stayed in Phoenix, I wouldn't survive, and that was the same decision that thousands and thousands of others were making at exactly the same time. And many went to New York or L.A. or someplace else, but a special kind of boy and girl came to San Francisco, and I write about that. You know, we had bell bottoms or button fly jeans, and you know, the boys that went to L.A. they bleached their hair and wore gold chains and went to auditions, and some would go to New York to go to law school or do real theater or something. But the people that came to San Francisco, we were a certain type of people, and we wrote poems, and we dropped acid, and we had sex in the park, and it was glorious.
Well, since you brought up sex, I'm going to talk about that a little bit, because I think you also punctuate your book with a lot of mentions about your love life. I don't think Anais Nin was as forthcoming about her love life as you are about yours. Was there any hesitation in writing this book about being so self-revealing?
I did a book, I think it was published in 2000 or 1999, called Stitching Revolution, that HarperCollins published. And I had a co-author. It wasn't a ghostwriter. It was a collaboration. Most of it was caffeine-fueled conversations that were recorded and then transcribed. And then my co-author kind of edited them down. But we had an editor at HarperCollins. I don't know why he thought, a lot of straight people were going to buy this book. But he just took out anything even slightly sexual. And it wasn't really my voice, because my co-author was much more literary than I. And it just doesn't sound like me. So I've been frustrated by this for years. I actually have boxes full of that book in my hall closet that we mentioned. And, you know, I don't even give them to people as presents, because I'm not, it's not a bad book, but I'm just not proud of it, and it doesn't sound like me. And it left out a big part of my life, which was and is sexual. And we were, it was a sexual liberation movement. And I wanted to do that. And the impetus came after the first day of trial in Judge Vaughn Walker's court for the Prop 8 trial. And Rob and Michelle Reiner were up here. You remember Meathead from All of the Family. And they were on our board, and we went for a walk in the Castro, and I was just yakking away, telling all my stories, and Rob Reiner put his big hands on my shoulders and said, "You have to write a book." And that, I think I decided right from the get-go that I wasn't going to hold back any of it. It's not graphic. It's, you know, it's not, I'm not too graphic. I don't think that. It's an important part of my life, and it's not something I'm ashamed of in the least bit, so why wouldn't I include it?
But it does get to one of the central questions you raise in the book about the gay community, so to speak. And you talk about how that, you kind of say it's one of the central questions is it really a community? Because the one thing that, or some have argued, the only one thing that brings us all together is what we do in our bedrooms. Otherwise, we're as diverse as can be. We're all the colors of the rainbow. We're rich, we're poor, we're educated, we're not. And so does that make us a community just because of we have a shared experience in our sex lives?
So this is part of the sort of central questions about identity that have been debated for very many generations now. And the first time it was really addressed in a very public way, using a vocabulary that we can sort of understand today, was in the 1950s with the Mattachine Society. And they came about during the period of the McCarthy era, a period of great repression, a period where people didn't talk about sex at all. Though also you had people like Masters and Johnson's doing their work. So it was just the beginning of it. The early feminist stuff was starting to come out. And Mattachine, one of the founders, Harry Hay, was from a communist background, very radical, and saw the need for homosexuals to organize in the way that racial and ethnic minorities were organizing. And then that was opposed, and there was this huge conflict that ultimately caused the demise of the organization. And Harry, who I got to know later in his life, Harry was one of the founders of the Radical Fairies. You know, he, and I'm paraphrasing poorly, but the way he put it was that some of us think that we're just like everybody else except for what we do in bed. And some of us think that what we do in bed is really not that different from everybody else, but we're different in every other way. And so this constant debate, and every generation thinks they're having the debate for the first time, and every generation employs a new vocabulary, whether you're talking about assimilationism or queer nationalism or heteronormative or whatever. You know, I don't know. Did the bulletin of buzzwords come out yet for this week? I don't know. But it's a serious issue, though. And it's, I judge people by the way they respond to that issue.
Well, how do you respond to it? What's your answer?
I'm queer. I'm very different. I don't think, you know, it's also like if you, I think somebody should do a book about this whole question of how we identify ourselves. So if you just, if somebody would come up to you and just say, "What are you?" And you had to answer that in one or two quick words without thinking about it, I would say, "I'm a gay man." I don't think I've ever met a heterosexual who would respond to that question by saying, "I'm a heterosexual." You know, and I think that that the answer to that question varies based on the color of our skin, our ethnic backgrounds, the experiences of our ancestors. My mother, if you'd asked her that, a white woman who grew up in England, she would have said, "I'm a dancer." You know, that was her primary identification, was not her skin color or even her ethnicity, though if you asked a few more, she would talk with pride about being English. I think for African Americans, one would get a different set of responses. But in terms of this particular question, I'm queer. That identity has been the most central part of my self-perception since childhood. And if I could take a pill that would suddenly transform me to heterosexual, I would flush that pill down the toilet too, because everything I've become is all connected to that. Now, I do live in both worlds. I have friends who are radical fairies who want nothing to do with anything heteronormative or assimilationist. And to me, part of what I do is just strategic. I think the movement continues to need to grow. And that means we need to persuade people and change hearts and minds. So even though I definitely feel my allegiance to that sort of left side of it, of the question, I'm also really interested in being able to communicate with the larger world and continuing to keep the conversation going and changing hearts and minds. I'm sorry, there are no short answers with me.
Well, when we talk about this question of whether or not we have a community, one thing that you go through again and again and again in the book is that when people are under attack, then we see a community form. And we're going to talk about some of the ways that this has happened, because you were right there at the beginning of them. And I think probably the first is when we see the gay civil rights effort begin to form, and we see Harvey Milk step up. We see a community that gets some political clout enough to get somebody elected to the Board of Supervisors. It was the highest profile openly gay elected politician at the time, and was a huge breakthrough. And you were there. Can you talk about that time and what that was like?
Well, you know, I think it's important to state, now that he's become so mythologized, that Harvey was a real person. You know, he wasn't a saint. He was not a genius. His personal life was often in disarray. He was a terrible businessman. Broke when he died. But his love for his people and for the larger city was really genuine. And, you know, I was still pretty heterophobic at that point, and I would have built a wall around my neighborhood to keep y'all out. And Harvey was this older guy. To me, he seemed so much older, and, you know, I'm now much older than he was when he died. But it was just really cool to see this older Jewish guy from New York just win the heart of the city, and to go campaigning with him and see how fearless he was at crossing all those boundaries and building alliances. Back then, the idea of an alliance between gays and labor was just really inconceivable. Today, it's something we just kind of take for granted. But Harvey built that first alliance with the Teamsters. You know, if you had to pick what would be the most homophobic, least likely union to ever support queer people, it'd be the Teamsters, you know? And we did that Coors beer boycott. And that was an astonishing kind of aha moment for me, because my family always supported the trade union movement. I was taught early on, you never, ever cross a picket line. And then the Teamsters, you know, supported Nixon and supported the war in Vietnam. And Harvey came up with this bold idea of joining the Coors boycott. But also, it worked. We got that beer out of almost every gay bar in North America and cost the Coors company and that right-wing fascist family a huge chunk of their market share. I mean, it cost them many hundreds of millions of dollars. So it wasn't just the symbolism of gays and labor and the Teamsters. It was the fact that we fucked Coors over, you know, and it was really satisfying. but also, he was just the kindest, funniest guy. He could be a total bitch and had a temper, but he was just the most genuine person. And in these days of politicians, you know, making significant eye contact and I feel your pain, you know, but it's all bullshit. But with Harvey, he just delighted in it. You know, you could just see it in his face as he'd be approaching some rich white lady from Nob Hill or some gruff black firefighter from Bayview. And he knew, I'm going to make a connection here and we're both going to leave and feel good about this connection and have some optimism for moving the city forward. It was wonderful. And he was never single issue. He was talking about displacement of the Latino community in the Mission in the 70s. He was fighting for rent control. He was building alliances. He was talking about the shameful way we treat senior citizens. He was fighting for kids' playgrounds. It was never a single issue. He kept talking about the coalition of the us's. And it's weird, you know, when you look at who's been representing that district recently, and let's not go there.
Well, one thing that's thinking of Harvey, though, in the movie, they showed how he had recorded a kind of in the event of my assassination, recording. And I was that wasn't a device in the movie. That was something he actually did. He expected to be assassinated. Talk about, I was amazed to hear that. I thought that was something that was made up for the film. I did not know that was something that was.
No, you can hear the tape. I used to tease him about it when he first told me that he'd done that. I told him he wasn't important enough to be assassinated.
Wow.
One of the eeriest moments of my life was listening to it while his body was over there, you know. But, you know, it sounds dramatic and prophetic, but it was also strategic because he named names. He said, these are the four or five people that would be acceptable to me as successors. And then he named people that weren't, people who he thought were too close to Feinstein. But the part that he didn't predict was that George would be killed too, and that it would be Diane making the appointment. But she felt obliged to appoint Harry Britt, a socialist, because Harry was on the list of favorable people, and he wasn't named Ann Cronenberg, and Dianne Feinstein was afraid that Ann Cronenberg would show up in leather at board meetings. That's true. It's a true story.
Why is the you talked about that Harvey's become somewhat of a mythical character, but you have probably done more than many people to push that myth forward. You were involved in the making of the film. You're somewhat responsible for Harvey being remembered. So why is it so important that we remember Harvey?
Well, we need to remember our heroes, of course. And it when AIDS came, it killed half of my brothers. And all those stories and all those memories went with them. And, you know, when I got to the city when I was 17, I loved meeting the old queens. I learned so much from them. If I met somebody who'd been in World War I, or, you know, I wanted to know, what was it like to be queer then? How did you survive? What were your strategies? And also, they gave me information, practical stuff, like how to not get arrested. And they took care of, so that transmission of stories through the generations was terribly and tragically disrupted by the pandemic. But also, any movement needs symbols, needs heroes. We want to have those. And by 2005, I felt like he was just disappearing. And with the quilt, you know, I've been traveling for most of my life, but especially after the quilt started in 87, and I would visit universities and college campuses, and I would say, how many of you know who Harvey Milk was? And maybe one or two hands would go up, and I was really troubled by that. So I understand the power of popular culture, and I worked with Dustin Lance Black and Gus Van Sant to get the film made, and Sean won an Oscar for it that he deserved, I think. And suddenly a whole new generation learned about Harvey Milk in November of 2008, and it was useful. But especially for the young people, when we mythologize these folks, we turn them into these kind of godlike creatures that we can't imagine being. Every one of you could accomplish just as much as he did. His successes, his, you know, and his life was full of all of the defeats and humiliations and setbacks that you've all already experienced in your own lives or will. So I just think it's important to honor his memory, but to do so in a way that doesn't distance him from our own experiences and our own aspirations. You can all be Harvey Milk. You can all be Rosa Parks. You can all be Cesar Chavez. All of us have within us the potential to change the world. That's what I learned from Harvey Milk, and that's what I hope you know about Harvey Milk.
And more than once, you literally picked up his bullhorn to get out on the streets. And I think one of the most memorable moments is, of course, when Dan White is found not guilty of murder because based on this, what we call now the Twinkie defense, that he was somehow addled by eating junk food and therefore he was not responsible for first-degree murder. So what followed then was, of course, a riot that went to City Hall. We've seen the pictures of City Hall being stormed, the windows being smashed, police cars set on fire. But what gets less attention, probably because there's not as much footage about it, is what happened next after the riots at City Hall in the Castro. Talk about that night, the White Night riots, and how that how the city reacted to that.
Well, there were a lot of things in play there. One of them was the federal court consent decree for the lawsuit that had been brought by the NAACP to desegregate the police and fire departments. But after the riot, you know, we marched on City Hall and we burned a lot of police cars, and then we went home to have a drink and they attacked us in the Castro. And the new supervisor, Harry Britt, the first thing he had to do was persuade the police to leave the neighborhood. But then everything really changed. And one of the things that happened was that Harry Britt and the other political leaders of the time said we would not apologize for it. And you know, I was raised Quaker. I abhor violence. But what happened that night, it had to happen. I'm very grateful no one was killed and no one was too seriously injured. It was very frightening. I've been in other situations like that. It's not something I relish, but it kind of had to happen. And it wasn't just about losing Harvey. It was about our whole relationship with the police department. The chant that night as we stormed down to City Hall was, Dan White was a cop. Dan White was a cop. So that's what it was all, what the rage was all grounded in, was, yeah, of course this aptly named Dan White would do it. And of course the DA would manage to impanel a jury that was all white and all heterosexual in San Francisco in the late 70s. That's quite an achievement, isn't it? So there were no apologies. And you know, you don't ever want to say something good came out of violence, but you know, we had more political power after the riots, and the police and fire departments were integrated, and LGBT people were hired, and we had more power, and I think people who say that no good ever comes of violence haven't read history much, you know, and I don't want to be that person encouraging violence, but we're living in a violent world and we ought to be realistic about it. It changed, the riot changed everything, and it changed the way we viewed ourselves. And it reminded me of what Allen Ginsberg said about gay people after the Stonewall riots in New York. He said, suddenly all these fairies lost that hurt look.
The next villain to appear on the scene is an unseen villain. It's a virus. AIDS comes to the community, comes to the Castro. In fact, one of the very first reports, I guess public reports of there being a virus is Bobby Campbell, a friend of yours, puts a notice up on the Star Pharmacy at 18th and Castro that says that he has noticed some lesions and wants to put the word out. So once again, you're there as a new chapter opens, a new threat to the community.
So after the Chronicle blamed the White Night riot on me, that I had to go to the grand jury, and I got through that, and that's a funny story in the book, but it's too long to tell now. But the big consequence for me after being accused of inciting a riot was I got an awesome job. Leo McCarthy was Speaker of the California Assembly, and Art Agnos was his right-hand guy, and they hired me to go and work as a consultant in the legislature, and I was assigned to work on the Assembly Health Committee. So my job was to review all of the legislation going to Assembly Health and then work with the Democratic members to let them know what the leadership's position was on these issues, to do speech writing and research. And of course, I didn't know anything about it. So I subscribed to everything, and this is, you know, back in the snail mail days, but among the journals, the public health journals I subscribed to was the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, published by the Centers for Disease Control. And it was in that, in the first week of June 1981, that I read what was the very first published words on the disease we now call HIV/AIDS. And I described these clusters of gay men. I think there were 43 at that point in San Francisco, New York, and L.A. I was immediately troubled by it, and I cut it out and put it on the bulletin board. I wrote just when things were looking up. That was June of 81. By November of 1985, almost everyone I knew was dead or dying or caring for someone who was dying. The death toll in the Castro hit 1,000 in the fall of 85. And the poster you're referencing, Bobby Campbell was an amazing guy. He was a sister of Perpetual Indulgence. And he was a registered nurse. So his drag name with the sisters was Sister Florence Nightmare RN. And one day I was walking by the Twin Peaks Tavern, the first gay bar in the world to have plate glass windows. And how many of you knew who Hank Wilson was? Anybody? Yes. Hank was just one of the most wonderful people I've ever known in my entire life. And he rapped on the window and said to come in. And Bobby took off his shoes and socks and showed me these purple spots on the bottom of his feet. And we took Polaroid pictures of them. And we handmade this poster, which, does anybody remember Star Pharmacy and Jackie? Jackie was this straight woman who worked in, she had this like 50s style bouffant hair, and she loved her gay boys, and she put it in the front window. It was so weird too, like she put it up, and within seconds there were dozens of men standing out there looking at it, because the word, you know, people were, it was so terrifying. And poor Bobby was treated terribly by a lot of people, but he was fierce and fought. And that poster, I believe, was the very first effort at public education to fight back against this new disease. I don't think there anything in the world had preceded that handmade poster taped up in the Star Pharmacy window. And we started the, Dr. Conant from UCSF called me because I was working for Agnos and I had just been transferred down to work in his district. This was after Willie Brown took over the speakership. And Art just gave me carte blanche to work on Castro. We started what was called the Kaposi Sarcoma Research and Education Foundation, which is now the San Francisco AIDS Foundation. And people forget, you know, we went over a decade without treatment. And during that decade, in San Francisco, we lost about 2,000 people a year, mostly in the Castro and Mission and Haight-Ashbury. I lost almost everybody. And then I made new friends, and then they died. And then I made new friends, and they died. And it just, it was very, very brutal.
Of course, today we have Facebook and we have social media, and so when a tragedy happens anywhere in the world, people rally, they pressure lawmakers, they do things. It all can happen very much in an instant. AIDS hits right here at home back in the early 80s, and the government responds with indifference, cruelty. Talk about that. And
you know, it's... it's frustrating me, you know, for me to watch how Reagan has been elevated to sainthood in some quarters. And, you know, he didn't say the word AIDS publicly until more of us had died of it than died in the entire Vietnam War. The Republicans had a convention in Long Beach at the beginning of it, and they had bumper stickers that said, AIDS, it's killing all the right people. Meaning, of course, homosexuals and African Americans and Haitian immigrants. I'm not sure what they have against hemophiliacs, but it was really, really cruel. And we weren't all perfect ourselves. A lot of the people who got sick early were shunned. But, you know, when the shit hits the fan and there's no one there to defend you, you defend yourself. And we did. And people did the most marvelous things. A woman named Ruth Brinker learned to her horror that one of her neighbors had starved to death because he was too weak to shop and nobody looked in on him. And he starved to death. So she started making meals for other homebound people who were dying of AIDS. That's called Project Open Hand now and has provided meals to I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of homebound people. People were losing everything, losing their homes. The storyline of my friend Ken in When We Rise in the TV show, you know, he'd been with his partner for, I don't know, 15 years and cared for his partner through that awful struggle before he passed. And then he dies and the family swoops in. You know, they'd never bothered to visit while Ken was sick. I mean, while Ken's partner was sick, they never visited. They'd never met Ken. And they threw Ken out in the street. There was a lot of cruelty. So we had to defend ourselves. And we created... We created an infrastructure that had been unimaginable just a few years prior. I think, like, Harvey's total campaign budget for that last successful win, I think, was somewhere around $30,000. And we were like, oh, my God, how are we ever going to raise $30,000? And then just within a few years, LGBT communities all around the country were routinely raising and spending tens of millions of dollars because we had no choice. We can't let people die on the street. We can't. And as we began to learn more about the disease, the government was afraid to do the education, so we had to do it. The government wasn't caring for the people that were sick, so we had to do it. The government wasn't housing people who'd been evicted. We had to do it. And it forced us to learn how to do this stuff. And I also think that, you know, there's a little bit of revisionism going on, and some of the younger people have probably already heard this thing about how the focus on marriage equality was imposed on the community by the rich white guys that run the big national LGBT organizations because they could raise money around it from these people who wanted marriage, and that this was being driven by the rich. You know, the rich didn't need marriage. They can afford lawyers. And when Gavin Newsom and Dennis Herrera first opened City Hall to gay marriage, they were vehemently attacked by the Democratic Party, by John Kerry, by Dianne Feinstein, by all the great white gay leaders. And as late as June of 2009, as you and I were talking about earlier, all of those, the 10 largest LGBT national organizations, including the Human Rights Campaign and the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force and the ACLU, said to Edie Windsor, don't go to the Supreme Court. Said to us in California, don't go to the Supreme Court. They said, wait for a better court. You know, plus they said, we should go back on the ballot. You know, just turning on its head the argument we'd put forth for decades that you never ever put basic human rights up for a popular vote, because whoever you are, if you give me enough money to buy airtime, I will take away your rights. It's bad, but they just, you know, they did this. And now young people seem to think that they were the ones that forced us all to focus on marriage equality. That's not what happened. What happened was when AIDS came, all those working class and middle class people of whatever color, skin, or ethnic background came to understand that that little piece of paper that we had said didn't matter, that vestige of the patriarchy that we thought didn't apply to us, suddenly mattered. And if you didn't have that, you could die because you didn't have insurance. So I think that not only was there this practical reality that that little piece of paper that was never, ever on my list of things I wanted for me suddenly became life and death important. And then there was something else that happened during that period, which was we all saw these dedicated partners dealing with the illness and their lesbian friends and their neighbors down the street and the volunteers day after day, emptying the bedpans, changing the PICC lines, measuring out the pills, washing the sheets, waiting up at night in the emergency room, holding the candlelight marches, making quilts, acting up, doing all of that. And then you say this isn't a marriage? Fuck you. You know, this is exactly what a marriage looks like. This is exactly what a community looks like. We want our rights. We want all of our rights. We're not going to settle for second-class citizenship anymore. So, you know, as I said before, marriage was never on my list. Just lately, it seems like maybe it might be. But I wanted all those rights. And when we did the March on Washington in 2009, you know, instead of the long laundry list, carefully crafted after brutal meeting after meeting with all the things we want, we distilled it down to one sentence. We want equal protection under the law in all matters governed by civil law in all 50 states, period. And that determination, I think, really has its roots in our experience with the pandemic and how we responded, not just as gay men, but the way our lesbian sisters stuck with us and fought by our side and cared for us. It brought a unity and a solidarity that is important to sustain and build on.
All that, and you had to then reach out to the larger United States to convince them to win the battle for hearts and minds there, and that's where we get to the quilt. The quilt today has more than 48,000 panels. More than 14 million people have visited displays of the quilt. How do you feel about those numbers?
Well, the names on the quilt are still just, you know, a small fraction of the worldwide death toll. I'm proud of it. It worked. And I was at something recently where a younger What's the derogatory term we're using? A social justice warrior was apparently exasperated about something, and they said, well, you know, it's not my job to educate you. Oh, but it is, Blanche, it is, you know. And I think, you know, self-righteous anger, you know, that's just such a warm, lovely emotion. You know, we just love wrapping ourselves up in that shit, and I'm so smug, and you didn't get the memo, you don't know? Well, I know. And that kind of self-righteous anger doesn't change anybody's hearts and minds. And I want to be clear, I supported ACT UP, and I got arrested with ACT UP. And I think what ACT UP did was incredibly important and valuable. I wouldn't be alive if ACT UP hadn't changed the protocol for the clinical trials. That's not an exaggeration. That's not hyperbole. I would not be alive if it wasn't for ACT UP. But at the same time that the guys in the Doc Martens and black leather bomber jackets were storming the NIH, I just kept thinking, you know, the two people on this planet that are going to grieve the most when this kills me are my grandmothers. I was the firstborn grandchild. You know, my grandma, my nana, they loved me fiercely, and I have no doubt that either one of them would have gladly given their own lives to save mine. And there needed to be a place for them in the movement. And I was struggling with that, the reality that with all the good that we were doing in the village and in the Castro, you know, there needed to be a way to reach out, to try to tap into that which is good out in middle America, all the people that would never consider abandoning their kids. That's the majority of parents, you know. We kind of can lose sight of the fact that there's still a lot of good out there, and I'm struggling to hold on to that with these election results. But anyway, the quilt worked, and at the beginning, I had the idea on November 27th, 1985, at the annual Candlelight Memorial for Harvey Milk and George Moscone. Every year we march. And that was the year, 85, when the death toll hit 1,000. And I was standing at the corner of Castro and Market. You know, go there. I mean, it's the same. It's the beautiful, restored Victorians. You hear music, smell coffee and food. You hear people laughing, and you're at the epicenter of those first 1,000 to die. Almost everyone had lived and died within 6 blocks of that intersection, and there's no evidence. And I was just obsessed with that. And I could think, you know, if this was a meadow with 1,000 bodies rotting in the sun, then people would look at it and see it and understand. And if they were human, they would be required to respond. But there was no response. So I just wanted to illustrate it. And that night, when we marched on November 27th, 85, I had ladders down by the old federal building, and we had a nun with a beard on a bicycle to distract the police, and with big rolls of tape, we climbed up and covered the wall with this patchwork of names. And it was a drizzly, cold night, and thousands of people just stood there reading all these names of all their friends and neighbors who had died. And I thought, it looks like a quilt. Thought of grandma, thought of my great-grandma back in Bee Ridge, Indiana, the quilt she made in 1952 that's still on my bed. And it was just, I thought, well, this is perfect. And everybody told me it was the stupidest thing they'd ever heard of. For a whole year, because I could see it in my head. I could see the National Mall covered from one end to the next, you know, from the Capitol to the monument, Washington Monument. I saw it in my head, covered with fabric with all these names. And I would try to explain it to people, and they would roll their eyes, and it's like, oh, girl, what are you thinking? You know, it's too expensive. It's too morbid. That's really complicated, Cleve. I don't know. Do people really sew anymore? And, you know, that chorus that is always there. The minute you say, I'm going to do this, they're right there to tell you all the reasons why it won't work and your idea doesn't matter, and it's really kind of stupid. And so whenever I get to speak with young people in particular, I always tell them, if you ever get something in your heart that you know you have to do and everybody tells you that it totally sucks, please tell them to fuck off and do it anyway. Because
I was surprised in the book that Nancy Pelosi, that she loves to sew. She was actually thought that she would do it, but she wouldn't think anyone else would.
Nancy Pelosi was incredibly helpful to me, and I disagree with her on a number of significant issues. But I have to tell you, she said, Cleve, you know, I actually like to sew. But I just can't imagine having the time to sew these for, because I've already lost so many people. She'd lost a number of very close friends early on, but she hosted the very first fundraiser for the Names Project in her home. And then when we went to take the first 1,292 panels were shown, 1,292 were shown on October 11th, 1987, a year and a day after Marvin Feldman, my best friend, passed. I made the first quilt for Marvin. The Park Service wasn't going to let us do it. Nancy goes in with her little Gucci shoes on, you know, and sits down with the Park Service and says, what's your problem? Why can't they put this on the mall? And they said, well, we're afraid it will kill the grass. It will smother the grass. And she said, really? And she said, well, if they fluffed it. I swear, this still cracks me up. Somehow, Nancy Pelosi, and, you know, she has that kind of breathy way of talking, but don't be deceived. You know, she's got a mind like a steel trap. And she said to the Park Service, well, I'm sure Cleve can easily find a way to fluff the quilt every 20 minutes so that the lawn can breathe. Okay, Nancy. And then, of course, we killed every blade of grass on the lawn.
We're ready to open up the session to questions from the audience. We actually have a microphone that we can race over if you have a question. And we are ready. Right down here.
First of all, thank you. It's an honor to be here. And as a young queer person, I have a question of how to stay persistent and driven to make a difference, especially in this political system right now.
This is such an important time, and we need everybody to be active and organized and smart and strategic. It's pretty toxic on the left right now. And after the women's marches, you know, the day of the Women's March, I was up at the Haight-Ashbury. A friend of mine had passed away from the old days, and we're having a little memorial, and, you know, it started pouring rain around noon, and I can't remember when Oakland started, but the San Francisco March was scheduled to start at 4 o'clock. By 3 o'clock, the wind was howling, and the rain's coming in horizontal. I thought, nobody's going to go to this march, but I will, and I called a taxi, not an Uber, and by the time we got down to Civic Center, I mean, it was a deluge. It was the biggest storm we'd seen in years. And it was the biggest march I'd been in a long time. And I'd heard people squawking about who was going to get to speak. I don't know anyone who heard any speakers. You know, it was a hurricane. And we sounded like a train, a locomotive going down Market Street. At one point, people just started yelling. And I saw grandmas and babies and every single ethnicity and skin color and gender and orientation and everybody carrying all their signs for all of their issues that they're concerned about. And it was, to me, it was really powerful. I needed to know that I wasn't the only one as horrified. It meant something to me. And then within 24 hours, the began. And people saying that this issue wasn't put in, or this issue wasn't there. And there were these letters being posted called "Dear White Women, thank you so much for finally marching." Okay, so let me get this straight. So you've got millions of people marching for the very first time to confront a grave threat to the entire planet, and your first impulse is to piss on them? You know, I don't like that. And then I've also heard, you know, this whole thing of, it's not my job to educate you. It is your job. So I think the first thing we all need to do is be nicer to each other, be more respectful to each other, and to not waste time on these endless debates about what works and what doesn't work. Everybody tells me marches don't work. I've heard many people tell me there's no point in voting. I've heard writing letters to the editor doesn't matter. I've heard so many reasons why not to do so many things, and it's a lie. All of these strategies work. Civil disobedience works. Voting works. Registering voters works. Turning out minority communities on election day works. Everything has its place, and all of it can be useful as long as it's smart and strategic and relentless. So what I would say to you is look in your own heart and your own personal experiences and look for those moments when you're doing this kind of work and really enjoying it. I love what I do. I really do. I don't want to ever retire. I hope to drop dead in a riot or on a picket line. I'm serious. I don't golf. Well, you know, and I just love what I do. I mean, my activism, I get to meet the most amazing people. It's brought love into my life. I feel useful. And it's because I love what I do. Even if it's just silly shit like figuring out what a poster is going to look like or the right time to post my event page, you know, to me, it's fun. So I've endured. We need you to make a commitment that probably is going to, you're going to need to honor for the rest of your life, because what's happened to our country is not going to be fixed in a few months or a few years. And those of us here who have gray hair like me, I don't think we're probably going to live long enough to see the damage of this last election undone. And those of you who are younger, I think are going to have to fight it for a very, very long time. So find that way to contribute that brings you joy. You deserve to be happy. And then when you are happy, you're not going to be one of these people, you know? Because they just piss me off. There's somebody over there. Yeah.
Over there, the aisle.
You've been involved in so many groups that, and so many movements, and at such great personal loss for the people, your friends who have died, and seeing so many people arrested and their lives being ruined. And despite your humility, you've had such a great impact on the gay and lesbian community, the entire queer community. And I don't have a question, but I just want to say thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
First, I do want to thank you for your work, and you're an amazing storyteller. And I do have a question, which is about how do you remember all of these things going back? Did you keep notes? Did you keep those posters? What did you do? But before I let you answer that, as not so young women of color, I do have to sort of push back a little and challenge you on dismissing the letters that people wrote. I think that was a way of people trying to educate other people. So there's people who say I should not educate. But those letters were meant to educate. And as a non-Black woman of color, when I read something like that, I try not to take it personally, because if I'm taking it personally, it means it is about me. So if it is bothering you, and my suggestion, especially because a young person asked this question, I would say, read it, take what you will from it, don't let it piss you off, figure out how to put it into action. And that's not where I would recommend anybody put their energy, is in shaming people who are trying to educate us. I understand the tone can be very, very hard to absorb. But I don't need you to respond to that. I just want you, because we do some documentation, oral history, and I'm really curious about how you have this amazing memory and these amazing stories. How did you know that this was all going to be so important?
Did you keep a journal?
I have some tricks. I totally agree with everything you say to that point, though, and I should have said a little bit more. The sentence I should have added to that is that the folks that do this are so rarely going to take the time to show up at the next organizing meeting and make sure that those issues are addressed. So I believe in the broader, larger movement, and I want to see all of those issues addressed in an effective way. And people have every right to criticize, but I want them to show up and not just be, you know, sniping on Facebook. Well, good. Because in my experience, the people that are the most critical are rarely the ones that show up to walk the precincts and turn people out. But I smoked a lot of marijuana in the 70s and 80s. So I think I was there. I'm pretty sure this all happened. I can't really swear to it, but about one of the things that was odd was, so at the beginning, I just gave myself permission to just kind of put down what I remembered. It was really hard to verify a lot of it because most of them are gone. I also, another challenge with this was that I wanted to have dialogue in it. I didn't want it to read like a history book. I wanted it to read like a novel, hopefully. And so recreating and reimagining dialogue from then is almost impossible, but there would be little fragments of some, you know, like some snippy comment somebody made or some over the top thing that I would remember. And like when I describe Gilbert Baker telling me about his idea to create a rainbow flag, well, I don't remember the conversation, but I knew that queen well. And, you know, so I just sat there and I imagined him rolling his eyes and I remembered fragments of conversations, and I just made it up. And then I called him. He was still alive, thank God. And I called him up and I said, girl, I got to read this to you. and I read it to him, and he said, okay, yeah, that's how it was. So I put in there, there's the, you know, this disclaimer that I recreate and reimagine conversations. There were certain little triggers, though, that were so helpful. And it's so easy online now. Whenever I started to get stumped about something, the first thing I would do is I would look up what were the top 10 songs that month. And then I would play them. It's amazing how much a few bars of a song can transport me back decades. And then also, I know this may sound silly, but I looked up weather. And in one particular part, it really triggered a really valuable, useful memory, which was that we'd had this heat wave that had been going on in the fall of 78. And then the news came from Guyana, and then the fog came back in. And I remembered that, because we'd been out walking precincts for the election that year, you know, and I remember that for some reason that change of weather did it. I also find that the sense of smell to me is very much a memory evoking sense. And sometimes I would just try to remember one of the early memories I had that was a very powerful memory that I later dreamed about that night was there was a coffee roasting plant at the base of the Bay Bridge. So when you came over, and my first trip to San Francisco, I came over the Bay Bridge around 4 o'clock and the fog's pouring down, and you would smell that rich, almost acrid smell of the coffee roasting plant. And for some reason that just brought back. Then another kind of bizarre thing that happened was right as I was, oh, and another thing was I gave myself permission to not write a damn history book. And so I stuck with the memories that I actually had or knew that I could recreate in a way that was honest and as truthful as possible. And I didn't oblige myself to tell other people's stories. There was always a tendency with that. Like when I started writing about the first doctors in San Francisco who were dealing with the epidemic, well, then I thought, oh, I've got to talk about Gottlieb in LA and Friedman Keene in New York. And I actually wrote a whole chapter about other people just because I wanted to acknowledge them. And then I took it out because it wasn't my own. Then just as we're getting ready for the last edit, I was interrupted for a while because both my parents passed, and it was a very difficult, awful year for my sister and myself. And we lost everything, and they were victimized by a predator, and we lost everything, and we lost our personal stuff. But somehow my sister was able to get a few boxes, and in the bottom of one of them was a journal I had no memory of writing. I had no memory of it at all.
From what age? How old?
It was just a journal that I kept when I was hitchhiking in Europe in 1977. And I ended up on this little island in the Balearic Islands called Formentera. And I started writing this. But not only was it a journal of what I was going through then, but it was a recounting of everything I'd done the previous 2 years of hitchhiking. And I learned that I had everything wrong. Like I thought I was in Egypt this year, but it was the other year. I had the crisis in Cyprus this year, and it was the year before. But my mom, and then also my mom had saved every single letter and every single postcard. So in there, I found like me telling her about my first meeting with Dianne Feinstein. But it was a little bit, the timing was difficult because we were going to press, and I had to, I worked for 4 days straight through just readjusting it all. I didn't do much. If more of them had lived, I would have checked in with more people. There were maybe a half dozen people that I had read parts of it. I wanted to make sure I had that bit about Harry Hay and the Radical Fairies and the Mattachine Society. I wanted to make sure I had that correct. So I went to a gay historian to deal with that. I'm happy with the way it turned out. I think it works, and it's, I can't tell you how excited I am to have young people reading it. I know 2016 was a horrible year for the country and the planet, but it was a pretty good year for me. And
we have time for one more question, right over here. I'm going to say, by the way, just a little editorial comment. I'm guessing that some of the good stuff in the book about your travels in Europe were things you did not include in your postcards to your mom. Let's point that out. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, in the same spirit where you talked about including your grandmothers in with the quilt and bringing them in, a lot of us that are working these days, we hear it's like we have to reach out to people in red states and reach across lines and call, you know, for the guy running in Georgia and things like that. Just in terms of political strategy, how do you see, what's the most effective thing that people can do in that regard in terms of winning the hearts and minds?
How do you get to the other side? You did this with the Briggs Initiative. You went to places where you were not welcome way back when.
Well, I'm not sure many of us are prepared for this part of it, actually. There's several parts to it. First is vocabulary. Particularly in the Bay Area, those of us on the left use a vocabulary that is just completely inaccessible and incomprehensible to ordinary working class, middle class people, regardless of their age, genders, race, whatever. It's just, I joke about it, but it's almost as if some entity issues a weekly bulletin of buzzwords and catchphrases that suddenly everybody feels obliged to use in every sentence that they write. And I don't find it useful. I want to use English or Spanish or any other language that people can understand. And I think there's a kind of an arrogance on the left. I'll leave that aside. Another part of it is patience. And you look at, okay, he's still getting 40% support. Some of those people are unwinnable. Some of them are just fucking racist. That's it. They are at their core racist, and they are unreachable. And I don't see any point in beating my head against that wall. But the person I keep in my head is my brother-in-law's father. My sister's husband is named John. Like my sister and I, John's family is also from Arizona. And John's mother and father both voted for Trump. Now, through marriage in our family, they now have grandchildren who are black and brown and Asian. And I have been to their home many, many times. I don't know if they love me, but I know I'm welcomed in their home and treated with respect and affection. And even John's father gets me a present on Christmas. So I think yelling at him and telling him he's a racist Nazi isn't the effective strategy. I sometimes almost bite my tongue off. So I think, you know, and then I also, there's this idea out there that identity politics, because we spent too much time, because the Democrats were too favorable to Black Lives Matter or transgender people or whatever. I think that's bullshit. I don't think that's what cost us the election. And I try to take a little bit of comfort from the fact that she did win the popular vote, even though, you know, she went into that with such high negative ratings. It's kind of amazing that she won the popular vote. And I'm also really conscious of the drop-off between the primary and the general, and I don't see how we fix that by rehashing it constantly. I'm dismayed by the amount of stuff I encounter on social media, even now, every day, of Bernie people attacking Hillary people and Hillary people attacking Bernie people. I don't see that that's useful at all, even though we may feel it strongly. I think this is the time to say, let's move on. And also to understand how social media isolates us. Like my brother-in-law, because he stayed in touch with his family members, his news feed is totally different from mine. And I have like 40,000 people following me on Facebook. I don't ever get Trump supporters posting anything. I don't see it because I live in this bell jar, and I think we need to be careful and strategic about reaching out of that and that. And, you know, and also like my exasperation about what we were talking about, it also has to do with, it's like when people were writing those letters, who were they, who was being hurt by those letters? Was it the enemy? You know, because the enemy wasn't reading them. And I think that that's is an issue for us, is to find the patience, the vocabulary, and enough respect for me to talk to my brother-in-law's father, who I do not see as an evil person. I cannot, for the life of me, understand anybody voting for this grotesque person. It blows my mind that a majority of white women voted for him. I just don't know. But I do know that I come from a movement that did change hearts and minds and profoundly transformed within one man's lifetime the way an entire class of people are viewed. We did that, and we did it because we were willing to stand up in front of audiences that spit on us, that called us faggots, that threw rocks at us. We just kept doing it long before we had political power, long before we had Will and Grace or Ellen DeGeneres or Anderson Cooper. We were coming out. We were revealing the truth of our lives. We were sharing our humanity with the rest of the world. And was it scary? Yes. Did it take a long time? At the time, it seemed like it did, but looking back, it seemed like it happened rather quickly. So that's kind of what I'm holding on to. And I have moments of great despair right now, real, anxiety that keeps me up at night. And I'm so worried about what's happening, but we're going to keep doing it.
I'm afraid we have to end it there. Thank you so much, Cleve.
Thank you all for coming.
When We Rise is for sale in the lobby. Get your copy and Cleve will sign.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.